Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Retail Refined, a market scale podcast with your host, me, Melissa Gonzalez. Today, I have a very special guest, and I know I say that a lot, but this is special in a unique way in that I have one of my colleagues on, Mark Taylor, who is also a principal at MG2. And we're really excited to dive into a conversation around sustainability together and with you. Mark Taylor has dedicated his career to building community-centric, mixed-use retail environments that inspire, entice, and delight. He's passionate and a champion internally at our organization as it comes to how do we integrate sustainability into our design thinking. He approaches projects from both sides of the coin. He keeps clients' concerns at the forefront while sustainability bending the rules where possible, bringing the light to unique design solutions that are greater than the sum of their parts. And that's a critical part of this because ROI is always a big part of the conversation when it comes to sustainability and really realizing it. Mark helps lead our integrated sustainability practice by cultivating wellness for the communities we serve and the communities we design for. He specializes in reducing carbon, energy, and water uses across all our diverse projects while reuniting people with nature. And we know that that is a big wish for the people that we are designing for today. So I am very much looking forward to diving into today's conversation and tapping into Mark's endless passion for bringing sustainability not only to the forefront of conversation, but to the forefront of implementation. Mark, thank you so much for sitting with me today.
Thanks, Melissa. I really appreciate the time and look forward to digging into this.
Yeah. So I think a kind of high level, even though it was personal at the same time, introduction. So for our audiences that are newer to you, can you add to what I shared in terms of your role at MG2 and leading sustainability?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So, like a lot of architects, as a designer, I kind of thrive on the impact that buildings have on our environment. And I also have a love of the outdoors. You know, I'm an avid hiker. I love being outdoors. And, you know, when you understand more about the impact that our designs and our buildings have on the climate, you definitely have this desire to want to do something about it. And I think this is my opportunity to do that. I've been involved with sustainability, you know, for a while since, you know, early in a previous firm, you know, early 2000s on. When I came to MG2 in 2015, I was asked by our CEO, Mitch Smith, to help us define what sustainability looks like going forward. And that was an honor to be asked to do that. As you might imagine, this kind of started off as very much a grassroots kind of effort. We had a couple of very passionate individuals in the firm. We'd gather together at lunches and, you know, kind of on our own time a little bit to brainstorm, you know, how to approach sustainability and really kind of understand, you know, understanding who MG2 is, who we are as a firm, and trying to craft a plan that was unique to our firm. So that grassroots effort kind of led to, more and more momentum that got built up around it. And it led us to committing to this AIA 2030 commitment, which is what we signed on to in 2020. And beyond that, we've just continued to grow. We've hired a full-time, dedicated building performance analyst to assist us in achieving this. So the commitment is real. The commitment continues, and you know, we're not looking back. So we're at this point full implementation mode, and that's why we're so excited to kind of unveil this 2023 impact report.
Yeah, it's definitely great to have seen the evolution. A lot of times, these start with grassroots and organically build into a more concerted initiative. So it's great to share that journey. And break down what that investment would look like. So for those who might be newer, because I do think in the industry today, there's a lot of awareness around sustainability when it comes to packaging and product development. And there's still a lot of education that's needed as how does that translate into the physical world, into the built world. So can you tell the audience a little bit more about what the AIA 2030 challenge is?
Sure. It is, being architects, the AIA is our kind of industry organization. And the AIA 2030 commitment is a voluntary commitment that we as an architecture firm will collect and report publicly the data for our projects. By data, we mean, the operating energy, which, is one of our goals, the embodied carbon, we're looking at that as well. And so these are all things that the AIA is tracking, and we've committed to reporting that data on a year-over-year basis. So we are in our third year of reporting, we're making a big leap this year, which is going to be all of our projects, up from some pilot projects that we were working to integrate this into our process more. The AIA 2030 commitment really is us being accountable to not only to ourselves, but also to the wider industry and the communities we serve.
I love that. So let's talk a little bit more about the report that we put out. So recently, MG2 has internally, but it will be published for public consumption. MG2's annual sustainability report, and this is really leaning into those four primary goals. So, can you tell us a little bit about the impact report, the themes, and what it's measuring?
Sure. This is something that we took on ourselves. While we report to the AIA, that's part of our commitment. We felt like it was, we needed to share what we're doing more publicly as well. We decided, starting this previous year, that we were going to commit to reporting this data and a report. This is really our way to publicly hold ourselves accountable and share this information year over year. So we're going to, each year that we, moving forward, we're going to report, transparently where we're at and, the good, the bad, and the ugly. If we are short of our goals, we're going to be honest about that, because it's going to motivate us to, as a firm, to get better. And that's the spirit of the AIA 2030 commitment. I mean, the commitment itself is difficult. That's one thing to recognize, that this is not an easy path. There's no set prescriptions necessarily, the goal is to be honest and to keep working at it. And that's the essence of the goal. That's the essence of what we're trying to do. So this report is part of what keeps us honest there.
Okay. So let's go through the main themes of the report. And I think what would be good is demystifying a little bit for the audience. So there's four themes. We have operating energy, embodied carbon, material sourcing, and water conservation. And I'm going to go through one by one. So with operating energy, let's demystify this for the audience a little bit, right? We probably have listeners who might work on ground ups. They might work on TI projects. So how does this apply to new construction, but also if you're working in maybe a smaller footprint TI project?
Sure. So, the real simple answer for operating energy is, we all get a utility bill each month, right? For our home or our office or whatever it might be. Operating energy is just tracking that utility usage, energy, gas, whatever, if it's a fossil fuels, whatever that might be, then it's what is supplying the heating, the cooling, the plug loads, the lighting, any electrical, need the building uses, that's what operating energy is. And so, of course, our goal is to reduce that as much as we can. And if possible, offset that with renewable energy or with other methods there. We do at NG2, we do both core and shell work, as well as retail TIs. And the approach to them is, it's similar, but it's different. With the core and shell, you're talking about a ground up building envelope. That building envelope is really that separation between indoors and outdoors. So the better envelope you can make, the less energy you're going to need inside to heat cool. So that's when you were starting with core and shell work, that's really one place that we start to look at, is how can we make that as efficient as possible? What's that sweet spot to really get it where it should be for energy usage? When we think about retail TIs, we focus more on lighting power density from an operating energy perspective. Lighting power density is the amount of light per square foot that a space has, that's really kind of one of the more primary focuses of our current goals. With LED lighting so prevalent now, you know, mm-hmm. that is an easier thing to achieve, but there are mm-hmm. still things that we can do as a firm and as designers to work toward that goal to make it, you know, even easier. So, from a retail TI perspective, as it relates to operating energy, you know, that's what we look at.
Yeah. So I think those are great analogies you gave, especially when you talk about LED lights and things that have become much more accessible and yeah. allow this to be a little bit more like lower hanging fruit, right? If a brand or retailer is saying, okay, how can I be more sustainable in my thought process? Let's move on to embodied carbon. I mean, where are we with that today? Where do we need to get to?
This one's a tougher one to unpack. I always like to kind of level set with what embodied carbon is, because, you know, I think mm-hmm. it's a word that gets thrown about, you know, but what it is, it's really about all the materials that go into a building or into, mm-hmm. whether it's a ground up building or whether it's a retail TI, we're putting new materials into those projects, whatever they are. And embodied carbon is a tracking. So if you can imagine, like, you know, the raw material being extracted from the earth and it mm-hmm. goes to a manufacturing facility, and there's a transport that happens to get it to that manufacturing facility. It's manufactured and then it's transported to a building site and then it's built. So, you know, we call that the cradle to gate. So that's, you know, from the cradle is from that raw extraction, and the gate is when it is in its built form. We can also look further beyond that to, you know, they call it cradle to cradle, where now you're tracking it, you know, through its life cycle to, you know, what happens after, you know, when that project is demolished or hopefully reused and recycled. So, you know, that embodied carbon kind of tracks all of that. And what we do is we look at both the quantities of the materials that we're putting into our projects, as well as the qualities of that material. And the qualities of that material, they really get to come out in the environmental product declarations, the EPDs, which are documents. It's kind of like the nutrition label for a material. So it tells you everything, you know, a lot more detail than you'd ever, you know, really want to know. But mm-hmm. one of the important things in there is the global warming potential for that material. So these EPDs are third-party documentation of materials that track that. And then we combine that with the quantities of the materials, and that gives us our overall embodied carbon impact, or otherwise known as kind of the carbon emissions for that building. And then that gives us a measurement to that we can start to you know, challenge and test how do we lower that.
So do you have a good example for the audience, like in those two scenarios, what would be a way in which you've helped and worked together with a team working on a TI project, for example, and you help them kind of work through what an opportunity there could be?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of, you know, one nice thing about retail TIs is you're always going into an existing building, and mm-hmm. existing buildings are inherently a great embodied carbon story to tell, because you're not rebuilding a new building. You're reusing something. And so I think that's a good place to start. I think, you know, one thing that retailers can consider is, you know, instead of just gutting a whole shop, and we've studied this on certain on some properties or some retailers is instead of just walking in and kind of demolishing everything in the space and starting from scratch, what of that space can you keep? What of that space mm-hmm. can you reuse in order to reduce your overall embodied carbon impact? So we could come in and do an initial assessment of, you know, what is currently in a space. What can we, you know, what is salvageable and reusable, and then what needs to go, and then compare that to where the design, you know, takes us, and marry those two things together in order to have that lighter touch on from an embodied carbon standpoint, and better overall for the environment. And, you know, and again, you know, whenever we look at we do a lot of renovation work as well, so. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one thing that we always consider is that reuse of the building. You know, is there still life left in that? Mm-hmm. We have one project in Chicago, Six Corners, where it was an old Sears department store, one mm-hmm. of these, you know, multi-level 1930s era Sears department stores that mm-hmm. that our client wanted to convert into residential, and I think that was reuse of an existing building, so it doesn't get any better than that from an embodied carbon standpoint.
No, absolutely. I think Sears is a good use case. Well, your third pillar is material sourcing, which I think has a ton of relevance across footprints and initiatives. What are the elements of largest impact here? Because I think depending, right, if you're talking about something that's 500 square feet, 100,000 square feet, there's a varying degree, but there's a lot of research that's being done. And what are the elements, again, of largest impact when we think about material sourcing?
Yeah, you're right. This is one that, there's people who dedicate their entire career to this new material mm-hmm. research. Sometimes we take it for granted. You know, we think that gypboard is gypboard and they're all the same, mm-hmm. but they're not. There are some gypboard brands out there that are better than that have, you know, less gypsum or better sourcing of those materials in order to reduce that global warming potential. So our material sourcing goal is really meant to collect environmental product declarations and health product declarations on the materials that we put into our projects, and mm-hmm. offer alternatives. You know, we want to compare materials to maybe what a client has typically used in the past, and then offer these alternatives that perform better, that from a durability perspective are the same, you know, from a usability perspective, but from an embodied carbon perspective could have a better quality that we can work with there. So I think the biggest thing about material sourcing is advocacy, and mm-hmm. we as designers need to be asking the suppliers on a regular basis, you know, do you have an EPD? And if so, I want to see it. I want to collect that. And then eventually getting to this place where if you don't have an EPD, then we are not going to spec your project, and mm-hmm. we're not going to spec your material for our project, because it's that important as we move deeper into this conversation. And this is happening. I've had conversations with some material manufacturers who already have done the homework and are ready to hand it over and are proud to hand it over, and others who are very resistant. And that mm-hmm. that's the part that concerns me a bit, because I think they're not going to be around for long. I don't believe if they don't get to the point where they are doing their part to address this concern.
No, absolutely. And I think, how do you present this to clients too? I'm curious. And we're going to talk about a successful approach when it comes to design. But a lot of the times where I've seen things get stuck is, okay, we get to a point where we source sustainable materials, but then ROI comes in, cost benefit analysis or cost comparison. Where do you think we're at in terms of the ecosystem with having solutions that are economically competitive? Or if they're not, how do we sell that into the client that the investment's worth it?
Yeah, you touched on a lot of good points there. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we can have large, you know, really high aspirations for what we want to accomplish at the beginning of a project. But you're right, when the price comes in, that's when, you know, we really have to test our, you know, where our values lie. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that we want to do, you know, what our job as a design, you know, firm is to bring these options to the table with a cost, an indication of cost in mind. Mm-hmm. You know, we know that's important, and our ultimate goal is to make sure that it gets sourced. So when we are evaluating our projects per our material sourcing goal, we're factoring in what the cost impact, relative cost impact of that could be. And we're going to look for materials that, you know, that also are competitive from a cost perspective. And sometimes we're looking at, when you're looking at the makeup of a wall system, are all those materials needed? You know, like let's, mm-hmm. let's, you know, can we, is there one material that we source that can, you know, mm-hmm. eliminate two other layers of that wall system, or, you know, like whatever the case may be. So we're constantly looking at, not only just that one material, but kind of all of the material makeup that goes into, the space. So, mm-hmm. so it's a complex, you know, scenario. It's a complex problem that we're trying to address. But we have to kind of keep it in mind from a bottom line perspective. A lot of times, you know, depending on it, when we're talking ground up buildings, corn shell, we may be thinking about a speed to market conversation too, because sometimes, you know, when you're looking at, let's say you're comparing a steel building, you know, pre-manufactured metal with a heavy timber or something like that, you know, there could be a speed to market conversation that happens there.
Sure.
Helps the tenants get open sooner because they're able to get that space constructed in a quicker amount of time.
Absolutely. And I know that's part of the research that you and the team are constantly doing, is thinking of those progressive and innovative strategies as well. And I love that you brought up timber. Let's go to the fourth pillar. I have lots more questions. Water conservation. What are the key tools that enable innovation around that today?
Yeah, you know, we talk a lot about energy, but we can't forget how important water is. That's really, you know, one of our most precious resources. We literally couldn't live without it. And it's becoming more and more, you know, scarce. You know, I'm in the Seattle area and we get a lot of rain. Seattle's known for their rain. Mm-hmm. Last year we were getting messages from, you know, our city officials to conserve water because, you know, we were in drought conditions and, you know, that's, mm-hmm. you know, I had to kind of do a double take when I heard that.
It's very atypical for Seattle, for sure.
Very atypical. So, you know, if it can happen in Seattle, you know, just, you know, imagine. No, you know, luckily it rained the next day, so I think we were okay. But it's a big deal, and I think so. We decided to add water conservation as one of our goals as well, to bring better awareness to that as a resource. And we track both irrigation, the water use for irrigation, as well as the indoor fixturing. So that's mm-hmm. those are places where we have opportunities for good impact. So it's about choosing. I mean, you know, it could be as simple as just choosing the right, you know, plumbing fixtures that have a low flow capacity, so that we are mm-hmm. You know, being responsible in terms of what we're speccing. Without sacrificing quality and usage, but making sure that that's in our purview. Mm-hmm. But we also, you know, we do a lot of work with Costco, and you know, one of the things that Costco, you know, we have helped Costco with is leak detection systems. Mm-hmm. So they have you know, they use a lot of water for irrigation and other uses across their site. And these leak detection systems not only help conserve water, but from Costco's perspective, help save money, because the worst thing you can have is, you know, a sprinkler system that's, you know, leaking water somewhere out in the parking lot that no one knows about for, you know, a couple mm-hmm. of weeks until a big enough puddle is formed. And that's wasted a lot of water and it's wasted a lot of money. So that's, one aspect that Costco looks at. And we're starting to look at that with Costco, with their processed water as well. So just all the other water that they use inside, and how do you be efficient with that?
Mm-hmm. I think what's great is all the different elements, right? As I mentioned, even with the materiality, the ecosystem coming together, that there's more accessible tools to be able to track that. And then we talk about the cost benefit analysis, and less waste is also positive to the bottom line, right? So making that investment up front over time, you could see how it pays for itself potentially if it's driving other cost savings. So we covered operating energy, embodied carbon, material sourcing, water conservation. I want to then, you know, our sustainability team that you lead also has a very, very data-driven approach. So what makes a successful approach to sustainability when it comes to design? How do you build a performance roadmap?
So, you know, there's a saying, you know, you can't improve what you don't measure. And that really holds true. And we've seen this, you know, in case studies where when we start to measure, we have assumptions about what works and what doesn't. We have as designers, we have that gut instinct about, you know, what the orientation should be, or, you know, where we should, you know, put glass or not, or skylights. There's all these different factors. But when you start testing it with data, we have energy modeling, you know, early energy modeling tools that we use that help us test this. Sometimes, you know, a lot of times you're surprised with the outcome. It wasn't what you expected. Mm-hmm. It wasn't exactly the way that you thought it was going to respond. And that could be because of, you know, a slight tilt of the orientation, the more specifics about the climate, or, you know, a whole variety of things that can impact that. And having that data is key. So our goal is to track this information for our projects, all projects that are in a design phase. That's concept through construction documents. So all throughout the process, we want to check this information at each one of those milestone phases to see how we're doing and check our progress, and with the intention that we're in, you know, improving and we're lowering the energy usage of the project. And so I think that's a key piece to our plan. And you know, when we get to the point where we're ready to share this with a client, it's really interesting because when it's one thing to show a beautiful rendering and a well-designed building, and then to bring up this, you know, and by the way, this is how this building is performing. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you know, a lot of the developers we work with, they're very numbers driven. They're looking at the financial aspects. But when you start introducing these performance aspects in terms of this quantitative data, their eyes, they kind of light up and they get excited. And then they start asking questions about, well, you know, okay, so this option performs this way. How, you know, what if we did this and this and this, how would it perform? And then that, like, oh, well, that's a great question. We can test that. We can use our tools, go back, and we can make these adjustments, and we can tell you exactly how it's going to perform, you know, at this stage of the design process. And that gets, you know, I mean, so, it becomes less, less of a, you know, gut reaction or a gut feel for how we think it's going to perform. And it's more of a question of, you know, in a relative sense, this is how it's going to perform. And, and we can have more pointed conversations with our clients about performance and about, all the, this information that's important for the overall health of the building.
Yeah. I think that relevancy and context is critical to the conversation, and it's great because you're starting it early in that concept phase. And then as things are getting further developing or continuing it through, the construction documentation. Could you share with us, I mean, you teased out a little bit some of the stuff that we do at Costco, but are there any success stories where our tools and methodologies were applied? What was the outcome? Just thinking probably of two scenarios there, like one where it's kind of a case study where it's part of our design process, and then another, because we also have additional services, right, that are a little bit more bespoke and custom, where maybe you helped a brand create more of a proprietary offering through partnership with you and the sustainability team.
Sure. Yeah, we've got a lot of really good stories that have surfaced over the years. And they come from all different places. And it's always, I'm always amazed to see how different organizations get to a similar place. For Costco, just to add a little bit more to that, like we've been looking at a Costco warehouse from a prototypical position and really analyzing and kind of, rethinking, how we approach those buildings and, from the ground up, from an operating energy and performance standpoint. We've evaluated their prototype building in different climate zones in order to understand, get a sense of how they're performed, how that warehouse will perform in different climate zones. And then also we're looking at the embodied carbon of those buildings too. So we're looking at it from this prototypical approach, which has this ability to scale, because, we work for Costco all over the country. And so that scalability is huge. And so that's one thing that we're doing with Costco. We do have another, a retail brand that we work with, they have many, many different store types all over the world. And, what they were looking at is, there are a lot of different sustainability frameworks out there, but none of them really spoke to what a retailer needs. And that gets into, I think you've mentioned it, the fixturing and the packaging and all the other things that go into that. So they asked us to help them put together a bespoke sustainability framework that is tailored to their needs and what is important to them and where they see the ability to have a huge impact. And so, you know, that's been rolled out as well. And I think, you know, that's a great story because, you know, the impact of these things is not just one project, but it's across, right, you know, many different projects. And I think this is the momentum that I feel like is building up. You know, it used to be that, you know, retail didn't have a whole lot of things to talk about in the sustainability realm, and now it does. And I think in the next couple of years, that story is going to just flip on its head. It's going to be, you know, and I think we've seen it too in terms of the consumer who you know is mm-hmm. leaning in to, you know, wanting sustainability, wanting that those values to be not only feel like they're getting it, but see the information and the data to prove that they're getting it on, so that, you know, there's not a greenwashing type of scenario. So I think, you know, a lot of retailers are really leaning into that.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the consumer, because the fact is, as consumers are getting more and more educated and more aware, and, you know, per some of our recent research in MG2 Advisory, consumers are seeing it as the brand and retail's responsibility, right, to live behind the promise of sustainability. So I think the investment has to definitely go beyond packaging or product. It's also the environment, which, you know, is a significant footprint for a lot of these brands and retailers and the way in which they interact with the consumer. Mm-hmm. So it's great that there's tools there to help measure that. And that's what I think is going to allow the scalability too, and seeing how these investments are paying off. Another thing that we talked about in your bio was, you know, the role that sustainability plays when it comes to wellness and well-being in communities. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, it is part and parcel to this conversation because, you know, wellness is such a huge component right now. And one of the things, we going back to our material sourcing goal, you know, historically materials, you know, the off-gassing of materials has been overlooked in some regards. I mean, you know, you always, you know, look forward to that new car smell when you got a, you know, when you got a new car, but little did you know that new car smell was really not the best thing for your health. And so, you know, really kind of understanding that is kind of where the education, you know, comes into play is, you know, we don't want these materials that we invest in to do us harm. And, mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, that's, you know, we have to kind of, you know, look at it from that perspective is, you know, every material has certain qualities about it. And, you know, there are that good, better, best type of scenario. And that's part of what our material sourcing goal does is it helps us understand the good, better, best, not mm-hmm. only from a global warming potential perspective, but also from a VOC perspective which equates to that health and wellness. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether we're thinking about it at that material scale, whether we're thinking about it from an envelope, like, you know, trying to design to passive house standards where, you know, the ventilation, the natural ventilation and the mm-hmm. the air quality inside of a building is at a level that, you know, is clean and safe. You know, these are the types of things that we think about when we're designing buildings so that we are putting forth a product that is not only is going to be, you know, an asset to, you know, to the people who are using it, but is not going to hurt them. I mean, it seems pretty basic. When you say it out loud, it
seems intuitive always. Yeah. And it's like, you know, actually committing to it, right? And I think it's important to understand too that a lot of times there's a sustainability conversation and there's a wellness conversation, but there's a holistic conversation that really should be had.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're one and the same and they're intertwined. And I don't think you can talk about one without the other. But you're right. We tend to talk about one without the other. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another kind of growth area that I think we have is really, you know, tying those things together more seamlessly.
Well, as you mentioned growth, that leads me to kind of one thing I want to leave the audience with is, what is your outlook about the future? Like, let's be real. What worries you, you know, as you and the team are digging into all this research, and what are the opportunities for the built world that lie ahead that gets you excited?
Sure. I mean, there's a lot to be excited about. You know, I'm an optimist by, you know, just by nature. And so I see this momentum building up. I see it within our firm. I see this enhanced awareness and kind of you know people are reaching out more to talk about what can I do. But I see it in our industry. I see it in just everything that we do. You don't have to, you turn on the news and there's a climate change story. And so that the topic is out there, so it's mm-hmm. everywhere. So it leads us to what are we going to do about it? And yeah. I think, we have that part to play. So I'm encouraged by that. The things that worry me, a lot of times, people feel like, well, I'm all for sustainability, but just don't ask me personally to do anything about it because mm-hmm. I'm set in my ways and I'm on my path. And so somebody else can take care of that. And that's, I think that's one of the things that, that we need to, need to shift that thinking is that, no, this is something we all need to address. We all have a part to play. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges, but even having said that, in the last, couple of years, we've seen that start to turn, and it's like anything. You have your mm-hmm. early adopters and it's getting to yep. that tipping point. And I think, this is kind of where we're at, where I think people in the design industry are realizing, well, as a career move, I need to know how to address sustainability in a meaningful way. Mm-hmm. And increasingly in a data centric way. So, while I think there are still challenges there, I think there's also a lot of opportunity because more and more people are kind of getting to that point where they know they need to address it. They know mm-hmm. they need to be a part of the solution and they're learning the part they have to play. And so I think that's, that's my both my hope and what I'm seeing kind of happening out there is going to shift to more people getting involved. And that's encouraging. Mm-hmm.
No, and as I mentioned, we're seeing that here at MG2, and it kind of started grassroots, and we had 18 pilot projects in 2023. We have more in 2024. Our, sustainability impact report is out, really breaking it down into these pillars that you're making more understandable, not just for this audience, but for brands and retailers that we work with or plan to work with in the future. And again, the end user, consumers, yeah. are understanding it more and more too. So, and then the ecosystem coming together more, right? Where there's more tools that you can measure with, and the supply chain's getting a little bit more accessible. So pricing's getting to be a little bit more accessible when it comes to materiality as well. So it's promising. I think, as you mentioned, but we're in such early innings of it, and there's so much more to be demystified. So thank you so much for sitting with me and sharing all this with the audience. And I think we just got to we got to stay on top of the conversation and how should people follow you, as you're putting more out there into the universe?
Yeah, no, I'm excited with everything. And I think this first inaugural sustainability impact report, I believe, it's the first of many. So we're going to be, putting it out there and sharing it, with as much people as we can. Because I think it'll just help push everything forward even quicker. I appreciate the opportunity, Melissa, and this has been great just to kind of sit down and talk. And I'd love to maybe come back next year and be proud to say we've made a huge jump in our reporting and in our projects.
For sure, absolutely. And in the meantime, people will follow you on LinkedIn. Yep. Look up Mark Taylor, and if they want to read, if you want to read the report, it'll be accessible on mg2.com. So look out for that. And again, we're just in early innings, but it's great to see year over year progress. And we're going to continue to talk about it so we can continue to build awareness. So thank you again, everybody. This is Mark Taylor, one of my fellow colleagues at MG2, principal, leading our sustainability initiative.
Thanks, Melissa.